Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, we grow up hearing fairy tales about kings and queens, princes and princesses. But royalty isn't just the stuff of fairy tales. It's actually one of the oldest forms of government. For thousands of years, kings, queens, emperors, empresses, czars, kaisers and sultans have wielded power, gone to war and invaded countries. But while some monarchies have fallen by the wayside over the years, alongside countless political leaders too, some royal families have modernised to ensure their survival. But how long can they continue? Have these ancient institutions had their day, or are they and all their traditions worth preserving? How much power do modern day monarchies actually have? Why are so many of us fascinated by it? Well, tonight we have two experts on monarchy who are our guests. Professor Robert Hazell is a professor of government and constitution at University College in London. Robert recently finished collaborating on a book about the constitutional monarchies of Europe. He joins us from London tonight. Hello, Professor Hazell.
Hello, good evening.
And in our Sydney studio, we have John Rees, a professor of international relations at the University of Notre Dame in Sydney. John, good evening. Welcome to you.
Good evening.
Well, before we delve into Prince Harry and what Meghan are up to, let's go back a little way and do some history and a bit of housekeeping on it. Robert, there are two main types of monarchy, aren't there? An absolute monarchy and a constitutional monarchy. Can you explain the difference to us?
Yes. A constitutional monarchy is one where the monarch is essentially a figurehead and no longer has any real or effective political power. And all the European monarchies that you mentioned in your introduction, there are eight of them, including the UK. That's three Scandinavian monarchies, Belgium, Netherlands, Luxembourg, Spain, and the UK, are constitutional monarchies. So the queen or the king in the other monarchies has no political power. It's a largely ceremonial role. It's still enormously important. These are long-standing monarchies. They are very popular with their people. One of the things that we found in our researching our book is that they have popularity ratings between 60 and 80%. These are ratings politicians would die for. So they have survived while modernizing. Absolute monarchies, and John is more of an expert on these, I think, than I am, tend to be found in other parts of the world, in particular the Arab countries and some of the monarchies further afield. And there the king is a real ruler, and the king appoints the rest of the government. The king is in charge of foreign affairs, and the king still is a king in, as it were, a medieval sense. European monarchies were absolute, but over the centuries since then, they have become parliamentary monarchies, constitutional monarchies, where the ruling is done by the government, and the monarch, as I say, has a largely ceremonial role.
John, how long have monarchies been around?
Well, it depends on where you go. The Emperor of Japan, who sits on the chrysanthemum throne, like that title, has been around since the 7th century. Of course, the notion of kings and queens and monarchs and indeed emperors has very ancient roots. Mm. And so it's a very fuzzy line between where the modern monarchies begin. But modern monarchies can really be measured when they start to differentiate, I guess, in ways that Robert has described, constitutional monarchy and absolute monarchs. What are the role of monarchs relative to their people and in particular relative to law and to parliaments? And so when it comes to absolute monarchy, for example, it's not the case that every absolute monarch is a tyrant or is a tyrant all the time. It is really to do with the powers invested in their rule. Are they able, for example, like the Saudi king or the king of Jordan, to dissolve parliament or to veto laws? This would not happen here. It would not happen in a constitutional monarchy arrangement, but it could happen in an absolute arrangement.
John, how many monarchies are there around the world then?
Well, it is a little bit of a fluid number, but when we're talking about sovereigns over nation states, we're talking about something like 28 sovereigns or monarchs who rule over 44 nations. Now, when we think about the UN system is comprised of 193 nations, mm-hmm. that's a very high percentage of countries which have some sort of fundamental, whether symbolic or absolute, relationship.
So you'd be counting Australia in that as a constitutional monarchy.
So the figures are a little bit fragile in terms of the high percentage, because it's also the case that should monarchies with large realms, 16 sovereigns for the Queen of England, for example, for the Queen of Britain, Queen Elizabeth, for example, were that monarchy to collapse, then those numbers reduce greatly. So it comes down to sovereigns and sovereign domains, as well as the number of countries that they rule.
Now, the most recent monarchy to fall was Nepal, I think, in 2008. What happened there?
Look, it's a tragedy of Shakespearean proportions, I'm afraid. 2008, I believe it was, Nepal's crown prince entered a royal family gathering, a long fractured history, royal machinations, opened fire with a semi-automatic gun and killed 9 people, including his father, the king, before shooting himself. I believe the royal palace is actually a tourist site now. Now, Nepal is a very complex context. We had Marxist insurgents, we had royals, sometimes, believe it or not, in coalition, and we had a fledgling democracy. And so very complex political space, and caught up in all of that was the palace intrigue, which basically the royal family turning in on itself.
And so what? How did that actually, I mean, obviously the king was shot. Who actually took control and said, right, we're not going to be a monarchy anymore? How did that happen?
Well, the parliament took over. And in one sense, the absolute nature of a monarchy dissolved itself. The inherited crown prince, who was the one who committed the crime of dissolution of the monarchy, was actually in a coma for some period and was declared to be the king before he passed away. And so in one sense, Nepal is a good example of, if you like, the isolation of a monarchy, which when disconnected from a populace can become very vulnerable. And in this case, it became extinct.
Now, Robert, how did monarchies ensure their survival? I imagine there'd be a lot of clever marriages being made.
Partly, indeed, dynastic marriages. And we can see in recent history, let's take the 20th century, some examples in Europe of what happens when monarchs, in effect, step out of line. And the answer is that they either get shoved aside. Sometimes that happens through a referendum, sometimes simply through action by the government, or they're forced to abdicate. Or in some cases, the monarchy comes to an end. And it's quite startling just to remind ourselves that in 1900, the start of the 20th century, every single country in Europe was a monarchy, except only 3. And most of those monarchies actually were swept away following the First World War and then the Second World War. So the First World War saw coming to an end big monarchies, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Russian Empire, and the German Empire. And after the Second World War, there were half a dozen lesser monarchies in Central and Eastern Europe that came to an end. And they ended largely because of defeat in war and therefore because of the failure of the monarch and the previous system of government. So monarchies have to adapt to survive. That's the secret of their survival. And certainly all the modern European monarchies have adapted over the centuries and are still adapting. Their powers are still being reduced, still gradually changing at the margins, and that's how they have managed to remain remarkably popular.
John, you want to jump in here?
Robert is absolutely right there when it comes to the adaptability of monarchs. Monarchs represent, in some respects, the negative stereotype of what we think about traditions as being stuck in their ways, as being unchanging. But actually, if we look at traditional practices and the monarchy is a part of that, you see high levels of adaptation, high levels of reformation, high levels of rethinking their reason for being, their connections with the public. We see a very dynamic picture, and this is, I agree, the key to their survival.
Now, Robert, when Walter Bagehot wrote the English Constitution in the 1800s, he suggested the monarch has three rights. What were they, and do they still apply today?
They were the right to be consulted, the right to encourage, and the right to warn.
Mm-hmm.
And they definitely still apply today. Intriguingly, one of the things we found in the other European monarchies is that they have exactly the same tradition as we have in Britain of a weekly meeting between the Prime Minister and the monarch. So the consultation is frequent and regular, and they also have the same tradition that those weekly meetings are completely secret, in that nothing is disclosed about what is said on either side. And so the monarch enjoys the confidence of the Prime Minister.
So no one really knows if the monarch has steered a Prime Minister a certain way or not.
That's right. And it's very hard to tell how much influence, if any, these modern-day constitutional monarchs have in those regular meetings with their Prime Ministers.
So they may have some, but they may have none.
Mostly they have none. If they have any, it's probably very little. We probed very hard during our researches and asked anyone that we could to find out what influence they might have had. And it has been marginal. I'll give you a small example, that the Queen of the Netherlands, for example, ensured that the Netherlands opened an embassy in Jordan, another monarchy, as it happens.
Mm-hmm.
And she also ensured that the ambassador to South Africa was replaced by somebody else. It's that marginal.
How dependent, then, are monarchies on the support of, of the English people, Robert, for example?
All monarchies.
British, I should say.
All monarchies ultimately depend on popular support. In all the European monarchies, there are very regular opinion polls, and they show extraordinarily high levels of support. It's one of the great paradoxes of this ancient hereditary institution. First of all, that it's survived into modern times and in modern democracies. And secondly, that it continues to be so popular. When it becomes unpopular, and I'll give an example of this, then the monarch may not survive. And the most recent example of that was in Spain, where the previous king, Juan Carlos, had become deeply unpopular, partly because of corruption within his own family, partly because of an unwise hunting trip that he made to Botswana to shoot elephants. Forgive me, I'm losing my voice. And opinion polls in Spain showed that 2/3 of Spaniards felt he should abdicate, which in due course he did.
We might let you have a good cough there, Robert. I might just go to John for a moment and say, look, John, what about these other monarchies that you can talk about in more depth around the world, the ones in the Middle East, the ones in Asia? Are they dependent on popular support?
Yes, they are. In one sense, the channels of popularity have to be read through a cultural lens. So, for example, in Thailand, the Thai king has a very close correlation with the Buddhist notion of the God King. So there's a very lived and real experience of devotion to the Thai King. In Japan, the constitution of a post-war Japan describes the emperor as a symbol of the state and of the unity of the people. So there's a highly symbolic link to the emperor. But again, coming out of the Shinto tradition, and in one sense, the notion of order, the notion of cohesion, the order of a certain predictability that is nonetheless accessible to everyone, becomes very, very important around the world. I do agree that where there's a disconnection between the people and the monarch, there can be problems for the monarchy, and absolute monarchies can turn tyrannical when there's that disconnection. But equally, what that connection is really has to be read in context, and it's very different from place to place.
So do you have any examples of an absolute monarchy that's lost that connection and has turned tyrannical?
I think, in one sense, the fragility of monarchs around the world, there is a common pattern, and one is where service to the nation and service to the national interest is not perceived to be at the forefront of the relationship between the monarch and the people. The structure for absolute monarchs that is very important for them is the military structure. Mm-hmm. And so when King Pomipom Adunade in Thailand passed away in 2015, there was a sense in which not everyone was looking to the royal family to see what would happen. Everyone was looking to the military to see what would happen. Now, critics of monarchy, and particularly of absolute monarchy, would see that this is a perfect storm for tyranny, mm-hmm. where you have an unchecked power in the palace and you have generals at their behest or vice versa. And so whilst there's no contemporary story in recent years of absolute monarchs becoming tyrants per se, there have certainly been strong concerns. This can relate to Saudi Arabia, for example, the House of Saud and its very close relationship with the Saudi military establishment, and equally where a political society lacks a middle class. Mm-hmm. And the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia would certainly relate to this area. I think the House of Saud, as muscular as it can appear, is also very fragile. Fragile to its resource base, fragile to its military dependency, and with no middle class to mediate between the lower classes and its own elite privilege.
On Nightlife, we're talking about monarchies, not so much, although we are talking about it, the British monarchy, and we're going to talk more about Harry and Meghan later on in the program in our issue of the day. But really, we're looking at the structure of monarchy, the institution, monarchies around the world. Our guests are John Rees, a professor of international relations at the University of Notre Dame in Sydney, and also Professor Robert Hazel, who's a professor of government and constitution at University College in London, and who is joining us from the BBC in London. Robert, how important is the spectacle of monarchy to ensuring their popularity, the royal weddings, the babies, the pomp and ceremony involved when the Queen opens the British Parliament each year?
I think spectacle is essential to the concept of monarchy and to the way that monarchs are portrayed to their people. And it has been so down the ages, along with royal dress, which is also very important. It was in the Middle Ages. It was for a monarch like Queen Elizabeth I. It's still important for the current queen, who remarkably manages to be a nonagenarian fashion icon. And look at the next generation. Look at how much interest is paid to what is worn by Kate, the Duchess of Cambridge, or indeed Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex. So monarchs have to be seen to be believed. Queen Victoria discovered that the hard way when she was widowed in the mid to late 19th century, and for a decade or so became effectively a recluse. And she was strongly advised by her prime ministers, in particular by Disraeli, that she should show herself more, advice which she heeded. And the monarchy did become unpopular during that time that she was, in effect, hiding away. So display, presentation being frequently seen and being seen on all state occasions is really important for monarchy.
Mm. And what about the relationship between the media and the modern-day royals? Has the ramp-up in coverage of royalty, particularly Britain's royal family, taken away some of the mystique that monarchy has had historically?
Well, Badgett, whom you quoted earlier, said the secret of monarchy is its mystery. And we've certainly torn away the veil. And I think that has two potential risks. One is for members of the royal family to be caught up in celebrity culture. And we can certainly see that happening perhaps in relation to Prince Harry and Meghan, who we'll talk about later. The other related to it is how little privacy members of the royal family have, because the press are very intrusive. We find this also with the European monarchies, but the British tabloid press is particularly intrusive, and I think it's very, very tough on members of the royal family, particularly the younger royals, trying to bring up young children, that they effectively have almost no private or family life.
And John, someone on the SMS, Leslie in Lismore, wants to know, is the King of Tonga an absolute monarch? And how do the kings of Fiji fit into the criteria that you're discussing?
They're very good questions. The King of Tonga and the kings of Fiji historically have been absolute monarchs. But in one sense, if you're talking about the situation in Fiji, one could argue that absolute power has tended to reside more in the military, mm-hmm. but also in conversation with tribal chieftains, as it were. And so when we're talking about contexts like Tonga, Fiji, later we might talk about the Zulu in South Africa, for example, cultural nations, we're used to speaking quite positively, I think, about the language of nations. Nations aren't simply countries that have sovereign boundaries, but peoples that identify around a particular ethnic and linguistic heritage and connection. Many nations around the world have revered leaders that you could argue could be deemed to be monarchs of a sort. And so Tonga and Fiji historically feature monarchs that are an upscaled version of a localised monarch right. in many parts of the world.
Now, you mentioned the kings of Fiji. How many are there?
This would depend, again, on how one defines the notion of monarch. Mm-hmm. And so it would really depend on how the primary leaders within particular cultural groups, between nations in the constellation of islands that make up Fiji and other countries as well, would be counted.
We're talking about monarchy. Monarchy, the institution, on Nightlife tonight on ABC Radio. You're with me, Suzanne Hill, filling in for Phil Clarke this summer. I want to have a look at religion and monarchy now. And I just want to play a clip from Series 1 of The Crown.
Monarchy is God's sacred mission to grace and dignify the earth, to give ordinary people an ideal to strive towards, an example of nobility and duty to raise them in their wretched lives. Monarchy is a calling from God. That is why you're crowned in an abbey, not a government building, why you're anointed, not appointed. It's an archbishop that puts the crown on your head, not a minister or public servant, which means that you're answerable to God in your duty, not the public.
I'm not sure that my husband would agree with that. He would argue that in any equitable modern society that church and state should be separated. That if God has servants, they're priests, not kings. That he would also say that he watched his own family destroyed because they were seen by the people to embody indefensible and unreasonable ideas.
Yes, but he represents a royal family of carpetbaggers and parvenus that goes back, what, 90 years? What would he know of Alfred the Great, the Rod of Equity and Mercy, Edward the Confessor, William the Conqueror, Henry VIII? It's the Church of England, dear, not the Church of Denmark or Greece.
That's a scene where Queen Mary tells her granddaughter, who's a young Queen Elizabeth, that the monarchy is a calling from God. John, would that scene from The Crown be on the money when it comes to the ties between monarchy and religion?
Historically, yes. Whether we are personally drawn to religion or not, when we think about the best of religion, saintly lives, for example, we think of some sort of a call, in this mm-hmm. case, some sort of a divine call, particularly to serve others. And I think that monarchs are at their best, one could argue, when they are seen to be servants of society, and they're at their very best when they're called to be servants of society. So there's that sense of sort of divine call and mission, if you like. But ironically, I think that the cynicism and the pessimism around monarchy is very similar to when religious institutions fail us. When religious institutions fail society, we become so angry because not only have they let us down, they've let their very reason for being down. Now, inseparably, whether they're successful or whether they fail, there's some sort of parallel to call higher principle. So historically, I think the link to religion just can't be denied. And in some ways, depending on the monarch, that sense of core will be embodied either personally and certainly is institutionally.
Now, you see the Pope as a monarch of sorts, don't you?
Yes, I do. I mean, in one sense, that's quite a descriptive element. The Vatican is a microstate, and the Pope is in some way a sovereign ruler over that domain. In terms of the international Catholic community that he oversees, you could argue that the Pope embodies a blend of both absolute and constitutional authority. Cardinals are called the princes of the church. We're not talking about a nation state so much when we're talking about global Catholicism, but even in the micro state management, certainly I think he does wield some element of constitutional monarchical power.
And then there's the Aga Khan, who's the spiritual leader of Shia Muslims around the world. Isn't their role more religious than royal?
I should clarify that the Aga Khan is the leader of Shia Muslims in the Ismaili tradition. There's about 15 million of them worldwide. Mm-hmm. So the Shia community that we see represented in Iran, for example, would not recognise the Aga Khan as a monarch. But there's certainly a very important role, and he would be considered to be an absolute monarch, the Aga Khan. If any of our listeners are interested in architecture or in education, we might have heard about the Aga Khan Prize for this or the Aga Khan Prize for that. Very liberal, very cosmopolitan, quite a contemporary movement. And the paradox is, oversitting that entire community structure is an absolute monarch, a very modern absolute monarch, owner of resources, extensive wealth, but in one sense, a very religious figure revered by his community to be a prophet all the way to the origins of the prophet himself in the Islamic tradition, Muhammad.
Right, let's take Suzanne, a look. Oh, sorry, Robert. Sorry.
Could I add something briefly about the links with religion in the British monarchy?
Absolutely.
Because there are still close links. I mean, formally, the Queen is supreme governor of the Church of England. When she became Queen, she was crowned at her coronation in Westminster Abbey by the Archbishop of Canterbury. And she was given the sacrament, and she, in part, I think, part of the reason for her extraordinary devotion to public duty is that she regards it also as a sacred duty, solemnized in her coronation oath. And we're not alone in still having quite close links between church and state. The Scandinavian monarchies do as well. And there, the monarch in one country is still head of the church, in the other two still has very close links with the church, which has only very recently become disestablished.
Mm. Now, Robert, we might take a look at some of the other European monarchies. It's something like a third of the EU's population lives in a state which is a monarchy, don't they?
That's right. There is around the northwestern fringe of Europe, if you can think of it geographically, half a dozen monarchies, the three Scandinavian countries, and Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and then an outlier to the south, Spain, which was only fairly recently restored, just 50 years ago, as a monarchy, plus, of course, Britain. And so there's a long-standing tradition in Western Europe of monarchy as a form of government. And although there are some, particularly in political science, who tend to argue or generate to think that these are antiquated, archaic institutions which will gradually disappear one by one in modern democracies, it's one of the paradoxes of these monarchies that actually they include some of the most advanced democracies in the world. Again, political scientists, particularly in America, love constructing league tables, and some of the league tables are things like the Democracy Index. Guess which countries come top of the Democracy Index? Countries that, like the ones I've mentioned.
No, Denmark, the constitutional
Norway,
monarchies.
Sweden, the Netherlands, etc. They're all constitutional monarchies.
And seen as some of the most progressive in the world, those Scandinavian ones in particular. John, you want to jump
Indeed.
In here?
Yes, I just wanted to add from an academic note, my home discipline is international relations, and we like to think that we specialise in breaking down different kinds of actors, institutions, those entities that animate world politics that help us to understand what's going on. So we talk about countries and transnational corporations and non-government organisations and international organisations, terrorist groups, etc., etc. Not one primary first-year international relations textbook would give 10 pages to monarchs. And it's one of the quite bemusing elements to the study of world politics that in some way monarchy is seen to be drifting off into the mist, whereas the conversation that we're having today is testament to the fact that they are significant actors in world politics, and I think that they should be retrieved as a point of study, including, you know, obviously the work that Robert and his colleagues are doing.
But Robert, you couldn't argue, could you, that the European monarchies are significant players in world politics? I mean, do they really have any influence on it?
No, I can't pretend that they have huge influence. They are used, coming to the points John has just made, in international relations, particularly through state visits. Mm-hmm. And most of these monarchs will make a couple of state visits each year to another country, and they will receive incoming state visits. Diplomat will tell you that they receive many more requests for state visits than the monarch can manage. So the state visits themselves are very popular in trying to foster good relations between different countries and also different peoples. They're also used in another respect, which is perhaps a bit more tricky, and that is sometimes as part of state visits, sometimes separately, they're used for trade missions to promote trade, to boost the exports of their country. And this can become tricky because it's beginning to involve the monarchy for a commercial purpose, and it can lead the monarch or other members of the royal family sometimes to deal with some slightly shady characters. So, for example, in Britain, Prince Andrew, for about 10 years, was dubbed our trade envoy and led several trade missions to countries like Kazakhstan and others, where, yes, he won or helped companies to win contracts for arms exports and the like, but it did involve dealing with some fairly shady characters. And the Spanish monarchy has got into slightly similar difficulties in relation to promoting exports, in particular to Saudi Arabia, with allegations, never proved, that possibly the Spanish king received kickbacks on those deals. So when monarchs get involved in trade missions as well as in international relations, it can get them into difficult waters.
Yeah, so as soon as you start expanding the remit, you risk really polluting what makes the monarchy, I guess, considered by many so pristine. Robert, why have the ones we've talked about, the monarchies in the northwest of Europe, survived when those in France and Russia went by the wayside? Was that just a quirk of history, do you think?
It's partly indeed that because they are on the northwestern rim of Europe, they were not so completely caught up in the two very big world wars of the 20th century, which swept away the other European monarchies. But it's partly because they were more astute in adapting to modern times. Amazingly, when we did the work for our book, I learnt that during the 20th century, there were 18 referendums held on the monarchy in 9 different European countries. And it was through referendums that the monarchy came to an end in countries like Italy and Greece, or indeed that it was restored in a country like Spain.
And of course, we tried it here in 2000.
You've also had a referendum, which your Australian listeners will know very well about, so we needn't talk about that. But interestingly, in some of the countries where the monarchy has survived, like Belgium, Denmark, Norway, they've also held referendums which endorsed the future of the monarchy, that those countries wanted to continue as monarchies. And it underlines a point that we were making earlier, that fundamentally the continuation of any monarchy depends upon popular support.
Now, since the 1970s, some European countries have changed laws in terms of succession to make it more gender equal. I assume that's been a good move, as the monarchies, you know, can't be accused of not being modern in that regard.
That's right, and it was started by Sweden, and then all the other countries followed suit, with one exception, Spain. And the most recent monarchy to change the rules of succession was indeed Britain, but also, together with Britain, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Jamaica, and all the other countries where the British Queen is also head of state, the 15 other realms. And it was a complicated exercise coordinating changes in the law and the constitutions of those 15 other realms to ensure that in future the rules of succession would be gender neutral. It took a couple of years. It was announced in Australia at the meeting of the Commonwealth Heads of Government, which was held in Perth in 2011. And it was finally enacted in the succession of the Crown Act here in Britain in 2013, and through other laws or constitutional changes in all the other realms.
Now, is succession always hereditary, or are some monarchs elected?
Succession in all the European monarchies is hereditary. There used to be elective monarchies in the Middle Ages in Europe, not all of them, but some of them. And you can understand for a modern ear why an elective monarchy might actually be preferred, because you were then choosing, I mean, from within the royal family, the person most suitable to be the monarch. And in the Middle Ages, monarchs all had to be warrior kings as well. They had to be physically brave and strong and capable of leading armies into battle. But towards the end of the Middle Ages and subsequently, the system of hereditary succession gradually became dominant as a much more certain and effective way of identifying the successor. But there are still some elective monarchies around the world, and perhaps John would be more expert at talking about those. My understanding is, for example, that the Saudi monarchy, for example, is in effect an elective monarchy.
All right, we'll get John to jump in on that.
Yes, that's absolutely right. When we think about the House of Saud, let's not think about a nuclear family.
Mm-hmm.
Let's think about a very complex set of clans, of tribal leaders, as it were, on the Arabian Peninsula. And in one sense, the Saudi king is elected from that class of people, or from that network of clans, as it were.
All right. And so do the sons and daughters of the elected king hold any kind of, are you considered more likely to be elected as the next monarch than others?
It really depends. And you can imagine the power struggles and the machinations that we would imagine
absolutely
be in a quasi-medieval structure of courtiers and those emissaries that are running between factions.
Mm.
And so, it's a raw political process. And in one sense, power and the ability of the strong leader, and in the Saudi case, it is the strong man mentality that is still quite dominant.
Mm.
And that sees the next, not only king, but the next king and those for whom he will primarily, those whose interests he will primarily represent.
So it's a power struggle the whole
Indeed.
Way along. John Rees is a professor of international relations at the University of Notre Dame in Sydney. And Professor Robert Hazel is a professor of government and constitution at University College in London. He's joining us on the line from the BBC. So, John, let's stay in the Middle East. How dependent are the monarchies? We've got Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Jordan. How dependent are they on oil revenues?
It's a very difficult question to answer, in the sense that oil revenues are propping up, in one sense, the elites of these nations. The problem for the royal houses in these nations is not so much revenue dependence on oil reserves, for example, but as I was alluding to before, just the buffer of the middle class. Where there is not a middle class, monarchs are vulnerable, because there's this very large distance between the rest of the population and the royal elite. And in one sense, the vulnerabilities of monarchy are always exposed when there are no mediating factors. Mm. And so there are no mediating factors in a political economy that is dependent on one thing, such as oil. There are no mediating factors when there is no middle class to help an isolated monarchy. And so we get, similar to the Nepal situation, the prospect of monarchies turning in on themselves when they haven't got those checks and balances. Mm-hmm. Monarchies are surprisingly vulnerable where they exercise power that is unchecked. Unchecked power looks strong, but in essence, over time, we know that it is actually very weak.
So are those monarchies perhaps more vulnerable in the future to collapse?
It depends on where you are. I would say that the King of Jordan has done a wonderful job in a very tumultuous part of the world to mediate between Western interests and his regional authority, between multiple religious demands in a very pluralistic, religiously pluralistic context. So King Abdullah and his predecessors have done a very good job. I would say the House of Saud and the Gulf states are more vulnerable because they are very key players in some very high-stakes security games and in one very important dimension, military conquest. And the success of monarchy is always a very vulnerable state of affairs for any king.
Now, John, let's head to Africa. I want you to tell us a bit about the Zulu king in South Africa. Now, he rules over the largest ethnic group in South Africa. How does that monarchy work?
Members of our listening community might remember, if they can, the succession of Nelson Mandela to the prime ministership of a post-apartheid South Africa, and how important in those early negotiations King Buthelezi of the Zulu nation was for those negotiations. The Zulu that number about 9 million in South Africa are a very significant ethnic group and nation in KwaZulu-Natal and elsewhere. The South African constitution certainly places the Zulu king under the rule of law, similar to how we would understand a constitutional monarchy. But those in the know, in terms of constitutionality, would see that the South African constitutional arrangement is also very advanced when it comes to acknowledging cultural rights, and the Zulu are a very good example of that. So certain legal and procedural rights that would not normally be given to a king or a queen in a constitutional monarchy arrangement are given in partnership between the state and the Zulu king along traditional lines. So if you like, it's a small S sovereignty mm-hmm. within the large S sovereignty of the South African nation.
Mm. All right, Robert, let's get to the elephant in the room. Let's talk about the big royal news that broke today with Prince Harry and Meghan Markle's decision to stand down as senior royals and divide their time between Britain and North America and work to become financially independent. They say they'll continue to fully support the Queen, but it's been reported that the Queen is deeply upset and Charles and William are, quote, incandescent with rage. But Harry and Meghan are a young couple with a young son. Harry's sixth in line to the throne. His chances of ever becoming king are pretty small. So why has this decision caused such a furor, do you think?
I think it's caused understandable upset and dismay, partly because it's quite clear there was absolutely no consultation before this announcement was made, so it's taken everyone by surprise. And that lack of consultation, I think, reveals an underlying problem, which is that Harry and Meghan apparently were no longer willing, in effect, to be part of the team. And the royal family occasionally is described and, I think, sees itself as the firm. And it's very important that all members of the firm, the royal team, play together under the Queen, support the Queen in all her duties and the other public duties that other members of the royal family carry out. In effect, they do so because they've been delegated to them by the Queen. And one of the difficulties, I think, is that other members of the royal family should not be able to pick and choose which duties they're going to perform. There are huge demands on the royal family. In Britain alone, and around the world, because the Queen is head of state of 15 other realms, they carry out just under 4,000 visits or other public duties every year. It's quite a big team. Until Prince Andrew, a couple of months ago, stepped aside, there were 15 members of the royal family carrying out these public duties. Now it's 14. It may go down to 12 if also Harry and Meghan step aside. And that leads me on to the third difficulty, which is that I don't think you can be half in and half out of the team. You're either a full member of the team, a full player, accepting all the obligations that go with team membership, or you're not. You can't be half in and half out. And reading their statement, it suggests that they want to continue to perform some royal duties, but to carve out for themselves a more independent life, and also possibly to themselves start to earn money independently.
So just to be royal when they feel like it, really.
Yes. There are, I think, for Buckingham Palace in particular, terrible shadows of the abdication crisis. And because it was really the self-indulgent behaviour by King Edward VIII which led to his abdication.
Robert, would you call this
a very long shadow over the current generation too?
Would you call this self-indulgent behaviour?
I'm afraid I think I would. That's what it sounds like to me. And there are an awful lot of details, obviously, still to be revealed. But I think it is self-indulgent to be able to pick and choose what royal duties you're willing to perform and which ones you're not. It's not generally known because we think it's all terribly glamorous, but a lot of royal work actually is pretty routine and boring. The Queen does huge amounts of paperwork, which she does very quickly and efficiently. She has to carry out lots of visits, as do the other royals, to schools, to hospitals, to all sorts of other organisations where they have to be very charming, very interested in everyone present, from the headmistress of the school down to the people who work in the kitchen, people they know they will never meet again. And they have to do that day after day after day. And understandably, it can become a bit of a chore, putting on your best face, going out to meet people, be very charming and interested in them, and then come home and next day have to go out on a similar mission somewhere else. And it is part of the basic coordination between the different royal households that they share out these requests for visits. And it does sound as though Harry and Meghan are saying they're no longer willing to do their share.
So do you think, though, if they do their thing, could this still have long-term consequences for the monarchy?
I don't think so. Clearly, it will be damaging to the institution, as indeed the difficulties with Prince Andrew were from the end of last year. But the Queen herself continues to be held in immensely high regard, to perform her royal duties in a very, very conscientious and effective way. The line of succession is assured with Prince Charles, who will become king when she dies, and further down the track with Prince William and now Prince Harry. So the future of the monarchy, I think, is not in doubt. Forgive me, I'm losing my voice again.
That's all right. So, John, looking around the world, human frailty, the desire of people to live ordinary lives is obviously a part of this decision. How much do you think that will be a role in assuring that the other monarchies around the world do survive?
Look, I think frailty is actually okay, and at times it's even celebrated by a populace, as long as that frailty reflects the needs and struggles of the populace at large. So divorce, for example, or family strife are things that good people go through. I think scandals such as associated with corruption or some of the terrible shadows that will now follow Prince Andrew for the rest of his life, are certainly elements that would undermine public confidence in any monarchy. I think the key here is that frailty might lead to some sense of opening the monarch up to increased levels of service. I think service is the currency. Service and certainty, I think, are the currency that monarchs trade in most profitably. And when the service is clear, for example, I'm quite surprised that we haven't had a stronger royal response to the bushfire crisis that we've had here in Australia. I think there was an opportunity for Prince Charles, for example, who is close to Australia.
He did make that video.
He did make the video, but it wouldn't take much, to be frank. Mm-hmm. This is my personal opinion, to hop on a plane and you know, be physically present. I know that that would be a large thing, but we are going through a large moment, and he is a monarch, future king, who's very close to Australia and very close to this issue. Now, that would really increase the currency, I think, in one sense.
All right, we're almost out of time. We've just got to just under 2 minutes left. Why don't I ask you both, how do you see the future? It's a big question, future of monarchies around the world. Do you think in another 40 years we'll have lost a lot, or we'll be sort of still having the same kind of number? Robert, what do you think?
Just speaking for the monarchies of Europe, I'm confident that in 40 years' time they'll still be around, because the secret of their survival has been their ability to adapt. Their understanding that to continue they have to respond to the needs of the people to remain popular. They all have surprisingly high levels of popularity, as shown by the opinion polls. And so long as they continue to adapt, I think they will survive.
What do you think, John? Can you see any that are ripe for a fall?
Well, where absolute monarchs become disconnected, I think they will fall. Where they become symbols of state unity, and that unity is represented throughout the populace, then I think that they will survive, whether they're absolute or constitutional. And I think that religious aura of monarchs will continue in some parts of the world to play an important role.
Thank you so much. John Rees, a professor of international relations at the University of Notre Dame, thanks for coming in and talking to us.
Thanks very much.
And from London, Professor Robert Hazel. We've wrecked his poor voice, but he's a Professor of Government and Constitution at University College in London. Robert, thank you so much for being part of our discussion tonight.
Thank you, Suzanne.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.